Look at Genesis chapter 24. Winter's here. I started mowing my yard late Friday night when we got home. As the sun was going down, I didn't get finished, so I finished yesterday while it was snowing. Everybody else is putting Christmas lights up as it's snowing, singing Christmas carols. I'm mowing. And then it covered up the grass. Now you can't see that I mowed. I should have just waited. The book's about done. We're just the final phases of adjusting the final pages that we're going to be sending into the printer. 550 pages long, 7 by 10, close to an encyclopedia size. Talked to the printer yesterday, finalized as far as the shipping and everything. Sometime around December 18th or so, we'll be getting 3.25 ton of books. 6,500 pounds. Yeah, I know, Junior. Junior knows what that's like. Yeah, they'll drive down my road, back up a semi. Yeah, we got 3.5 tons of books here. Put them in the garage. Put them on the workbench. So that's exciting times. We'll have those here for Christmas, I hope. So that's good news. There will be a CD in the back of the book cover also. So if 550 pages is not enough, we'll put a CD in there. And the CD will have the entire text on it. James is working on that, or going to be working on that. I just gave it to him now. But you'll be able to put it in the computer, the CD, and it'll have a PDF file of the entire book with all the images, a Word document. If you don't like PDF, you can use a Word document. Look at all the pages. Cut and paste it if you want. But then there'll be also a file of all the images, over 200 images as far as maps and charts and photographs and different things that, with high resolution, you'll be able to cut and paste those or put them on a projector or something like that if you want to use those. And then, of course, contact information and things like that. Plus, if you put it into your car, there'll be an audio message there introducing the book of Zechariah that we did Wednesday night a couple weeks ago. So the full package is right there. Anyway, that's the good news. Well, today, we're in Genesis chapter 24. This is the longest chapter in Genesis, and yet as you read it, it looks something, Isaac's going to find a wife, or someone's going to go find Isaac a wife. Isaac's going to stay home. Someone's going to go find a wife for him, and it appears to be, a romance story or something like that. I guess you got chick flicks, this is pretty much a chick flick, except it's scripture, so it'd be chick script. So today, if you're into chick flicks or chick script, this is your story right here. But of course, being the longest chapter in Genesis, it's more than a chick script. There's something taking place in here, and that's why it's recorded. And as we're going to see, one of the main themes is going to be the transference of the promise from Abraham and Sarah. Sarah died last week, and they purchased the grave, which was Abraham the alien purchasing land in the land of Canaan, the promised land, in anticipation of the future. I mean, this is his home. Although it's not his home, this is going to become the home of his people. So he buries Sarah there among the aliens. Well, in this chapter now, in a sense, Sarah is replaced by Rebekah. And throughout this chapter, you hear a heavy overtone of Abraham's at the beginning, but by the end, Isaac is the one that everything is revolving around. It's like a transference of the promise. It's the next generation. It's the fulfillment of what God called Abraham to do. He called Abraham out of the land of Canaan, or land of Ur of the Chaldeans, brought him to this and talked about his future, talked about the generations that are coming. This chapter is the fulfillment of that next generation. It's an indication of great things that are yet to come. And also, as we see Abraham, he stepped into history. He became important in history because of God's promise, that he believed the promise God gave him. As we see Abraham speak here, some of the final words that he's going to speak in the scriptures is his lips are, as he's dying or towards the end of his life, the last thing we hear him speaking about is that promise. It is important. He hasn't changed. I mean, he's grown, he's matured, but at the end of his life, what is important is the promise that God gave him and him watching over that into the next generation. You're going to see God's oversight of that promise, of him working, but you're also going to see people interacting, making choices, and responding to that call of God. Well, anyway, here we go, the chick script, Genesis chapter 24. this is going to, if you just take a look real quickly, you can see it's a long chapter. I'm going to read through it. It's going to have a little action there, a little dialogue between Abraham and his head servant, possibly Eliezer, but the chief servant. Again, this chief servant is going to be a brilliant, very capable man because Abraham's got many servants. This is the head of the servants. This man is very trained, very capable. Then we're going to see this head servant, possibly Eliezer, speaking with Rebekah and all that takes place there. And then we're going to hit a snag, if you want to, in the story, because now the servant is going to go to Rebekah's house and recount the whole story that we've just read and say it again. So you're going to have to read through it twice with me. Once while it's happening, and the second time while he's telling it to you again. But we're going to do that. Hey, while we're looking at our Bibles, go to the back. If you have maps, go to the back somewhere, if you would. And again, I can't tell you what map it is, but it's going to be a map of Abraham's journey, or the life of the patriarchs, or it's going to be the Old Testament map. And if you don't have maps, just look at somebody else's Bible. If you don't have a Bible, confess your sin and spend this time in prayer. But nonetheless, what I want to do, see if you can find on there, of course, find the land of Israel. We're not talking about Jerusalem yet. Jerusalem's still, the whole land is occupied by the Canaanites. Jerusalem's probably the Jebusites or a part of the Canaanite culture there. But if you can find like the city of Hebron in that area, even south in the Negev, which is south of Hebron, that's where Isaac is located right now. But then go up north to the land of Aram, or Padan Aram, Syria, in older Bibles, and the city of Haran. And that is where, just so you see, that's where we're heading. That's where the servant is heading. He's heading up to Haran. He's heading up to the land between the two rivers in the northern part. Again, you can see right there that they came out of Ur, the Chaldeans. They traveled up to Padan Aram. That's where Abraham went. And then he continued down into Canaan. His family members stayed behind. Many of them stayed behind. His brother stayed behind in the land of Haran. Abraham, as you know, had two brothers. He had the brother Nahor and Haran. Haran is the father of Lot. Haran has died many years ago. And Lot continued with Abraham down in the land of Canaan. But staying up in the land of Haran, or Padan Aram, up north there, was the son, or Abraham's brother, Nahor. Nahor is going to have a son named Bethuel, and Bethuel is going to have a son named Laban and Rebekah. I'm going to tell that to you again. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 24. Living up there in Padan Aram, in the land of Aram, near Haran, is Abraham's brother, or his brother that settled there, Nahor. Now, he has probably died. He may not be alive any longer. But Nahor, are you with me? Let's go to Genesis chapter 11. Genesis, so you can see this written out. Genesis chapter 11, we're looking in verse 27. And this is where I should have a chart to show you, but I don't. Chapter 11, verse 27, this is the account of Terah. This is Terah is Abraham's father. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran, his three sons. And Haran became the father of Lot. We know about Lot. While his father Terah was still alive, Haran died in Ur of the Chaldeans in the land of his birth. Okay, so that when Abraham leaves, he takes Lot with him. Abraham and Nahor both married. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. Now, Milcah was the daughter of Haran, or it was Lot's sister. So Nahor is going to marry Milcah. It doesn't tell you right here, but Nahor and Milcah, the important thing I'm trying to get to is this is Abraham's direct family. This is Abraham's family, and he's going to go in search of a woman from this family for his son Isaac. And it's a shot in the dark. He's going to put his servant on a camel and say, go back up there and find someone. And it's amazing how God interacts in this story. Well, anyway, Nahor and Milcah are going to have a son named Bethuel, which is mentioned in our story, but we never hear him speak. We never even see him in the story. But Bethuel is going to have, in our story, a son named Laban and a daughter named Rebekah. So this would be, as you go through this, Abraham had a son named Abraham had a son named Isaac. Nahor is going to have a son named Bethuel and then a granddaughter named Rebekah. Isaac and Rebekah are going to end up the negotiate together, and Laban is going to do the negotiation with us today. So when Abraham's, they're interacting here, this is Abraham's brother's grandchildren that he's getting a wife for Isaac. Go to chapter 24. Doesn't sound like a chick flick so far, Galen. Sounds like genealogy at the family reunion. Okay. I'm not real good at chick flicks, so maybe we should have someone else tell the story. Here we go. Chapter 24, verse 1. Abraham was now old and well advanced in years. He's not dying yet, but he's old. And the Lord had blessed him in every way. Again, he was blessed, had a family, he had servants, he had prosperity, he had peace, he was influential in his community, and he had the promise of God for future generations and was living in accordance with that promise. He said to his chief servant, again, head servant, this is not just, you know, some slave or some hired guy somewhere. This guy ran the operation. And it could be, it doesn't say his name here, he remains anonymous, but going back, it could be Eliezer, who at one time was the heir of this entire estate. It doesn't say that for sure. Eliezer may have died, some may have replaced him, but if we could assume possibly, since Eliezer, again, so competent that this was the position that was going to inherit all of Abraham's possessions before Ishmael and before Isaac. He said to his chief servant in his household, the one in charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh. I want you to swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I am living, but will go to my country and my own relatives and get a wife for my son Isaac. Again, the putting of the hand under the thigh is going to be used again later on when Jacob makes his sons promise that they'll bury him back in the land of Israel. It was a place of a covenant. It was a sign possibly of this man is the father of these people. This man that I'm making a covenant with is the one who's going to begin all the generations that will follow. And it was, again, a sign of a covenant. It was a common practice. Again, we sign covenants today or we are documents today or whatever. We shake hands. He put his hand under his thigh and had to swear. Now, again, you're going to see this servant is going to, he's wise. He's not difficult, but he's not presumptuous. There's so many things in here that indicate both Abraham and Eliezer, or the head servant, are not presumptuous. They believe in God. They're trusting God. They're going to step out as if God's going to fulfill the promise, as if they understand it. But there is also this thing going throughout this story that we must be conscious of, and I think it's very important. We read the Scriptures, we know God's plan, and we act on that. But there are things in life that we don't always know what God is going to do. We live by faith, not by sight. We live by faith in the promise. And so we step out and say, I'm going to respond to this. But God sometimes, as we all have experienced, will take a detour or he'll put up a roadblock. He'll send you a different direction. And to assume that there'll be no roadblocks, to assume that there'll be no detours, to assume that you know God's plan perfectly is presumption. Do you understand what I'm saying? This would have helped me so much 20 years ago in my own life, if I would have understood that. I thought faith was just bulldozing ahead, doing it, and just hitting your head against the wall until it got done. But there are times where you step out and follow God, knowing I'm not sure what God's next move is. God is always faithful, God is always true, but we do not know what God's next move is. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm not saying he's not faithful, I'm not saying he's not accurate, I'm not saying he's not true, I'm not saying he's not consistent. I'm saying he is, but sometimes in our human nature, we don't perceive that. Both Abraham and Eliezer are going to step out in faith. They're going to pray. They're going to hear the word of God and act on it, but then they're going to wait for God to respond. Do you understand the difference? I'm going to step out and now I've done this my part, God, what is your part? And we don't always know what he's going to do. Here it says right here, put your hand under my thigh. I want you to swear by the Lord. His titles, Lord, that's Yahweh, the God of heaven and the God of earth, similar to even words that were used by Melchizedek, the high priest and king of Salem, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites. Now what is up with this? Why not the Canaanite daughters? Well, one, of their culture. 2, if Abraham, who is an alien that has come over with the promise of God, talking about his future generations, if his family, if his son marries into the Canaanites, he's no longer an alien. He's a Canaanite. He's married into the Canaanites. One, it's their culture. They worship foreign gods. They're on their way through the four cycles of discipline in 400 years, or after they come up out of Egypt in 400 years after they go, they're going to be overthrown. Do not mix it up with this culture. Stay separate from this culture. But even more, God says, I haven't called the Canaanite culture. I've called you, Abraham. Do not intermarry with these people. Remain separate. This is the genealogy I'm going to work with. So he says, do not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I am living, but will go to my country and my own relatives and get a wife for my son. My own country, remember, Abraham has left his country. That was the beginning of the call. Leave your family, your country, your people. Leave this whole culture and go to the promised land. Now he says, go back to my country. Go back to my family and get a wife. And again, that's not Ur. They're going back to Haran. And when we think about that, it's not just someone from Paddan Aram, or not just an Aramean. It's got to be from the family that was left behind, from the family of Nahor and Bethuel. And it's like, where are these people at? Imagine them, how many people are living up north in Aram, up by Haran. How many people are living up there? He says, "Go, I want you to go back to my family, find them, and get a wife." Now, he's asking the servant to make a promise, make a covenant. Swear to me that you're going to do this. The servant, verse 5, asked him. He doesn't just say, "Yes, master, I will do this." He thinks, well, what are the odds of this all working out? One, I've got to find him. Then she's got to agree. Then she's got to agree to come here. And so he says this. What if the woman is unwilling to come back with me to this land? What if she doesn't want to come live in the land of Canaan? Then he asks a question, which he knows. It's a rhetorical question. He knows the answer is no. Shall I then take your son back to the country where you came from? Now, do you realize how ridiculous a question that is? After all that they've been through from chapter 12 through chapter 24, all that Abraham and his head servant have endured together to fulfill and live out the promise of God, to hold their position in the land of Canaan, they had to go through the famine, that they went down to Egypt, they had the issue with Hagar and Ishmael, they've had the thing with Sodom and Gomorrah, with Lot, they've had all kinds of issues to make sure Abraham holds on to this promise. So he asked the rhetorical question, if she won't come here, should I just take Isaac back up there? And it's like, absolute, well, right here. The NIV says, make sure that you do not. The maybe more literal would be, watch yourself. It's like, don't talk like that. It'd be careful, don't go there. That is unthinkable. Make sure that you do not take my son back there. Number one, do not do what you just said. Well, and Eliezer, or the head servant, isn't like thinking that. He knows enough not to do that. But he still says, clear this up. What if she won't come back? And here's what Abraham says right here. Make sure you do not do that. The Lord, the God of heaven, who brought me out of my father's household and my native land, and who spoke to me and promised me an oath, saying, to your offspring I will give this land. He will send his angel for you so that you can get a wife for my son from there. He says, wait, first of all, you're not taking Isaac back. Because the same God who called me here, now watch this, this is important. Because when God calls you somewhere, when God moves in your life, when God's got a plan, when His Word is working, He's not going to change His mind halfway through and say, this isn't working, and go another direction. Abraham confidently says, the same God who spoke to me, who appeared to me, and brought me to this land, who's brought us through these last years, through all the situations in this land of Canaan, He is more interested in finding a wife for my son than I am. In fact, He's going to send His angel ahead, and when you get there, things are going to work out. Trust me, the same God who called me here has got a plan, because this is the promise. This was the son that Abraham was ready to sacrifice, and the angel of the Lord says, no, don't do this now. He says he's got to have, Isaac has to have a wife. Just as surely as Abraham believed that Isaac would raise from the dead if he sacrificed him, if Isaac's going to continue the promise, he's going to have a wife. He's going to have a child. So he says, I'm sure that God is going to provide a wife. His angel will be there and will bring you to that woman. But watch this, verse 8. If the woman is unwilling to come back with you, now he's, but see, there's not being presumptuous. It's just like, it's going to work out. I'm trusting God, this was going to happen. But if the woman isn't willing to come back, if her own free will gets in the way, if for some reason she doesn't understand it, if God called Abram. He didn't put a hook in his nose and drag him to the land of Canaan. He appeared to him and called him, and Abraham, through a series of events, has responded and has matured in that promise. The same thing he knows. If you find the woman and you make the offer and you call her here, but she says, I ain't going to do that. He says, if the woman is unwilling to come back with you, then you will be released from this oath of mine. He says, if you find her and she won't come back, you're free. Your oath is your release from the oath. Only do not take my son back there. One option, you do not take him back. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of his master Abraham and swore an oath to him concerning this matter. He says, we'll be done. And he loaded up his camels and took off. Here we go right here, verse 10. The next phase now is the journey up there. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and left. Now again, imagine 10 camels. And he's not just driving all 10 of these camels by himself. There's servants going with him. There's men that are probably traveling with him. It's a caravan from Abraham up to the land of Haran, in the land of area of Haran. It's a caravan up there to find a wife and bring her back to Isaac. Now again, you can have the whole idea right there of who's choosing whose wife. It's like this is more about the family estate. This is more about the promise of God. It's more than who's in love with who and who's got some kind of emotional connections. It's like, this is the right thing to do. And he's going up there to find a wife. He's going up there to find a woman who's going to get on those camels with him and come back to a land she's never been to marry and live with a man she's never seen. So the camels are very important, because these camels are going to carry a demonstration of the life she's about to step into. And as he comes up here with all these camels, it's going to be very obvious the guy that wants to marry her has a lot of stuff, unless he's got it all packed on these camels. But nonetheless, then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and left, taking with him all kinds of good things from his master. So they're loaded with all kinds of good things. It says he set out for Aram Naharim. And Naharim means of the two rivers. Aram of the two rivers. So it's right up there where Tigris and Euphrates, where they're close together. That's where this land is at, just like I showed you on the map. Verse 13. Verse 11. He had the camels and made his way to the town of Nahor, near Haran. He had the camels. Now notice the name of the city, Nahor and Haran. They're both named after Abraham's brothers. He had the camels kneel down near the well outside the town. It was toward evening, the time women go out to draw water. So after making that journey, he's had the camels. They traveled, fairly quickly. Camels are very, quick animals as far as traveling compared to horses or mules or something. They got there in a good time, but of course they need water. After having traveled this long, they're going to need water. So the first place he goes is the gas station. Going to get refuel. He's got to refuel these camels. But it's the same time of day in the evening when the women come out, and one of their jobs was to come out and get water, take it back to the house. They didn't have running water. They'd take the water and take it back to the house and use it for the evening, and in the morning they'd get more water for the rest of the day. This is a common practice. Many things you talk about that, but wherever that water source was, the women would go to that well and bring the water back. This would explain, again, I just want to say this real quickly. When Jerusalem began to expand to the east, the city of Jerusalem, this is a sideline, I just want to say this. When it began to expand to the west of the city of David, the Gihon Springs were over in the Kidron Valley, which was very convenient for the city of David to get to. But when the city began to expand, for example, to the west, people would have to walk all the way across the western suburbs over the city of David, through the streets of the city of David, down in the Kidron Valley to get water at the Gihon Springs, walk back up through the city of David on the original site, the city of David, and go back to their homes. It was like a two-hour process, and you have to do it twice a day. Thus, what they ended up doing, the Hezekiah's tunnel, ended up bringing water over to the Pool of Siloam, which was right there in that western city. It was easier for the people to get water. It's not a big deal for us. We don't think about that because we just turn the water on. It just, we have a water bill we complain about once a month. But other than that, we just have running water. These people, their daily lives began in the morning getting water for the day and ended the day getting water for the night. And just imagine, everybody's going there. Well, it's that time of day. He pulls in to load up for water or refuel the camels, and the women go to get water. So there's many people coming and going. Now watch this. Then he prayed. Now, the word prayed is a good translation because that's what he's doing, but the Hebrew word is the word said. He's speaking. One of the things you notice, and you may have, we haven't really pointed it out, but throughout this book, anytime people are, in a sense, praying or communicating with God, it is not a cultic prayer or a ritual prayer. It's a conversation. How many times has God and Abraham spoken? And we would, you know, many times we would say, well, that's not really praying. He was just talking to God. God was talking to him and he was responding back. And here again, then he prayed, or the Hebrew says, and then he said, again emphasizing that even here in Genesis, the relationship that God has with his people is a personal relationship, a conversational relationship, something that he lived with them, spoke with them, they spoke with him. And here it is right here. And then he prayed, O Lord, God, Master Abraham, give me success today and show kindness to my master Abraham. It's all about Abraham. He's there on a mission. Show kindness to my master Abraham by helping me with this mission. See, I am standing beside the spring, and the daughters of the townspeople are coming out to draw water. May it be that when I say to a girl, please let down your jar that I may have a drink, and she says, drink, and I'll water your camels too, let her be the one you have chosen for your servant Isaac. By this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. So that's his prayer. He says, all these girls are coming and going, getting water. He's loading up his camels, refueling the camels. And he says, well, here's a good starting point. Here's all the ladies from the community right here. He says, Lord, he says, show mercy to your master or your servant Abraham. He says, when the girl comes and I say to one of the girls, can I get some water? And he's standing in front of all these camels. She will be the one who says, sure, but can I also water your camels? And again, there's 10 camels, and there would be troughs. And what they'd do, they would draw water out with their pitchers and fill these troughs up with water for the camels to drink from. They're not, you know, giving them, you know, little jugs themselves. They're just filling these troughs up. So it's going to be a lot of water. 10 camels refueling. She's refueling, you know, 10 vehicles. Can I get a Pepsi? Yeah, can I go out and fuel your cars too, all 10 of your vehicles? That's what he's looking for, a girl that gives him something to drink. And then says, I'd like to fill your camels up too. So here we go. Before he had finished praying or speaking to God conversationally, Rebecca came out with her jar on her shoulder. She, it doesn't tell him yet, but it tells us, the readers, she was the daughter of Bethuel. What's that? The son of Milcah. And Milcah is Haran's daughter or Lot's sister who married Nahor, okay, she is the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, who was the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor. I do want you to notice right here, Milcah is mentioned. Contrary to so many things being said about Christianity and Scripture today, women are key. It is not some great feminist idea that women are important. Scripture, from the beginning of the book, women are key. Sarah is a key player in this whole story. In fact, Sarah, right now, what we are doing is we are searching for a replacement for Sarah because the promise has to continue with Sarah and the women. Well, here, who's Rebecca the daughter of? She's the daughter of Milcah. So all of a sudden, all these women, it's not just the men that were important. The women themselves are being recorded and remembered because we've got Sarah, we've got Milcah, and now we've got Rebecca. The women's side is important. We can see that in Jesus' genealogy. Going on. Bethuel, son of Milcah, who was the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor. This girl is directly related to Abraham's family. The girl was very beautiful, describes her three ways, very beautiful, a virgin, no man had ever lain with her. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up again. So she went down, he watched her walk down, watches her walk back out with the water. The servant hurried to meet her and said, please, give me a little water from your jar. So he's watching her, and the thing is, you're going to notice right here, he's playing it cool. Inside he's praying, inside he's looking for a sign, inside he's getting excited because this is working, But he can't get too aggressive on the outside because he wants to watch God work on this behalf. She walks by, he recognizes she's very beautiful. She can tell that she's a virgin, that she is not married. She goes down and gets water, and as she comes back up, he just steps out and says, "Could I have some water?" The servant hurried to meet her and says, "Please give me a little water from your jar." Verse 18, "Drink, my lord," she says, and quickly lowered the jar from her hands and gave him a drink. Now again, we're looking at character here. We're looking at her ability to respond, to read situations. We're looking at her desire to work and fulfill. There's all kinds of things being demonstrated in her response. She stopped, took down the jar, and gave him a drink from the family water that she's going back home with to finish making supper with. After she had given him a drink, she said, as he's drinking, she's looking around, and maybe she's a little wise also. This man didn't come riding in on a donkey. This man didn't come walking with worn-out sandals. This man is refueling 10 camels loaded with stuff. After she'd given him a drink, she says, "I'll draw water for your camels too until they have finished drinking." So again, it indicates several things about her, that she's hospitable, that she's wise. She's not going to walk by an opportunity and watch her work now. So she quickly, now it describes her working. She quickly emptied her jar into the trough. So the water that she'd gone down to get, she brought it up, she gave him a little drink, she dumps it in the trough, and she's going to go down and get some more, and she fills these troughs up. And the servant, Eliezer, is just standing there watching this whole thing take place. Notice again. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough, ran back to the well to draw more water, and drew enough for all the camels, all his camels. Without saying a word, the man watched her closely to learn whether or not the Lord had made his journey successful. Now realize, he does not know this is Abraham's, what would it be? It'd be Abraham's niece, in a sense, or great niece or something. Figure that out. I'm lost now. But anyway, it's like his niece, almost. Verse 22. When the camels had finished drinking, the man got out a gold nose ring weighing a becca, and again, a becca is, it tells you down there, about a fifth of an ounce, and two gold bracelets weighing 10 shekels. Then he asked, "Whose daughter are you?" So to pay her for her work, he's going to give her a nose ring, which of course you all would like to have. Again, in this culture, the nose was a very, especially for the women, was a prominent feature, and they had put gold rings in it. Now again, I don't think, it's a like a big old hoop ring, maybe something a little more delicate. I don't know. I don't know the jewelry customs at the time. But nonetheless, it would have been an honorable thing to give her a nose ring, and her mom and dad aren't saying, "What? You pierced your nose?" It was something that was common. It was something they expected him to do. How times have changed. Back in the good old days, we'd pierce our noses. But anyway, I gave her that, and then two gold bracelets weighing 10 shekels, and asked, "Whose daughter are you?" I mean, this is the one. And now he's going to find out if God has made his journey successful. He's found the girl with a character. She's responded just like he said. Lord, he says, if I ask a girl for a drink and she says, "I want to water your camels also," that will be my sign to pursue this girl. But now the question, whose daughter are you? Oh, I'm a daughter of a Canaanite, or I'm a daughter of an Egyptian. I'm a daughter of whatever. It's kind of like, oh, never mind. Thanks for the water. And now here's the big question, and we already know the answer. Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night? She answered him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the son that Milcah bore to Nahor." And that's Abraham's brother. And she added, "We have plenty of straw and fodder as well as room for you to spend the night." So not only does she give him water to him and his camels, she says, "We've got fodder for your camels and a place for you to stay." Then the man, at this point, he breaks through his coolness. He's just getting water. He's just there refueling his camels. He realizes, I have stepped right into God's plan. Even before he was having his conversation or praying to God, these things were taking place. Here comes Rebecca. As he was praying, these things were unfolding, and he realizes, verse 26, "Then the man bowed down and worshiped the Lord, saying, Praise be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not abandoned his kindness and faithfulness to my master." Again, has not abandoned his kindness and faithfulness. Right there, kindness, his seed, the ideal of the covenant. Who has not abandoned the covenant and the faithfulness to that covenant to my father, my master Abraham. In other words, what he began in Abraham's life. This is amazing. I mean, we can read this. This is history. We know this. But imagine living through this. Imagine following Abraham, a man who's received a message from God, and having him live in the land for all of these years, and them saying, well, you know, they waited for a son. Finally, here's Isaac. And maybe Eliezer, or this head servant, was with him that day they took Isaac up on the mountain. They come back down and says, this is amazing what God is doing. Every day. It seems, you know, almost like a fairy tale when you read it historically, but imagine living this. Now he goes up to the foreign land or outside the land of Canaan and looks for a family member. And this girl steps into his life, does it exactly. He realizes, I am like walking in God's will. I am walking in God's plan. And he just stops, is just amazed by it and stops, falls down on his knees. And in one case, we're going to find over here in verse 12 when he prayed. You see in verse 12 he prayed, O Lord, and I told you it was a conversation. Look over in verse 45. When he recounts this story to Laban and Rebekah, he says this, before I finished praying in my heart. When it, back in verse 12, he wasn't even praying out loud. It wasn't a ritual prayer, or a cultic prayer, or a formal prayer. It was in his heart. He wasn't even moving his lips. He was simply praying in his heart, Lord, do this. He's cool on the outside, but he's praying on the inside. Now, in verse 27, he falls down on his knees and expresses out loud, praise be the Lord. This is amazing. I'm walking in God's plan. He is showing himself faithful to Abraham even at this phase of the game. As far as me, the Lord has led me on the journey to the house of my master's relatives. That's the amazing thing. As for me, I mean, he's blessed Abraham, but as far as me, I've left Canaan. I've come all the way up here to the land between the rivers up by Haran. And the Lord has led me on a journey to the house of my master's relative. No guidance as far as, you know, a satellite dish. What do you call those things? GPX, that it? That's what it's called, whatever. No maps, just I'm going this way, gets up there, stops and gets water at a gas station. I saw me at a gas station, and the person that comes out first, it's like, it's the person he's looking for. Unbelievable. Well, verse 28. The girl ran and told her mother's household about these things. Again, noticing in the mother's household. Now, Rebekah had a brother named Laban. Now, this is important because later on, when we get through the other later part in the book of Genesis, Jacob's going to meet Uncle Laban. Jacob's going to meet this guy and is going to deal, we'll get ripped off by him. But nonetheless, Rebekah had a brother named Laban, and he hurried out to the man at the spring. When Rebekah came running in with the nose ring, the gold braces, stories about the 10 camels loaded with this thing, so I hear, that's all she knows. Laban says, good enough, I want to meet this guy. As soon as he had seen the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's arms and had heard Rebekah tell what the man said to her, he went out to the man and found him standing by the camels near the spring. Come, you who are blessed by the Lord. Again, the word Yahweh. He said, why are you standing out here? I have prepared the house and a place for the camels. So the man went to the house and the camels were unloaded. Straw and fodder were brought for the camels and water for him and his men to wash their feet. Again, the servant and his men to wash their feet. He's not just traveling by himself. Then food was set before him, but he said, now so the whole situation set up, the food is set before him, hospitality to the max, which is typical of the Eastern culture. He's sitting there, his men are there, their feet are washed, there's food set before him, eat. But the servant says this, I will not eat, because again, eating again is part of the covenant. You've come in and you're being accepted by these people and you're making a friendly agreement. He says, before I eat, before I make this covenant of friendship with you, you need to know the truth. You need to know why I'm here. I'm not just traveling by. I'm not just stopping by with a lot of stuff. I'm not here to do business. You need to know why I'm here, because when we start eating, we're in agreement. So he says this, I will not eat until I have told you what I have to say. Then tell us, Laban said. So he said, and again, if you're bored at this point, I'm sorry, because now he's going to tell the whole story. I've been reading the story to you. Now the servant's going to tell the story to Laban that we've just read about. So just, you know, doze off. Tell someone you're going to sleep through this part, and I'll nudge you here when we get through this towards the end, okay? So he said, I am Abraham's servant. Again, they know who Abraham is. The Lord has blessed my master abundantly. Key. He has become wealthy. That's all. This is what he's got to offer him. He's saying, my master, the Lord has blessed him. He's wealthy. Not just blessed in his heart, blessed spiritually, although he is. He is loaded with stuff. He has given him sheep and cattle, silver and gold, men servants and maid servants, and camels and donkeys. My master's wife, Sarah, has borne him a son in her old age. Now again, this would be, in a sense, this would be Laban's uncle. Okay, you don't need to know that. You know what I mean? This is his only son. And Laban's dad would be cousins with Isaac. Okay. And he has given him everything he owns. Everything has been given to Isaac. Not will be, but is given to him. Including the ownership or the oversight of the servants. In other words, the servant Eliezer began the chapter as a servant to Abraham. By the end of the chapter, he's going to be a servant to his master Isaac. Because everything has been given to Isaac. And yeah, that's what this chapter is about. It's a transferring of the promise, the possessions, and the blessing of Abraham to the next generation. It's a huge step. And that promise has been coming now for generations. But this, that first transference of that promise, that's why it's a long chapter. And my master made me swear an oath and says, you must not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I live, but go to my father's family and to my own clan and get a wife for my son. Then I asked my master, what if the woman will not come back with me? You all know this, verse 40. He replied, The Lord before whom I have walked will send his angel. And this is important as he recounts his story. He's saying, when I said, the woman may not come back with me, what should I do? Abraham said, oh, but she will, because God will send his angel ahead and prepare the situation. You see what he's doing with this story. He's trying to show Laban and Rebekah, this is divine. In a sense, when you get down with this, what you've got is just like the God of glory appeared to Abraham in the land of Abram, in the land of the Ur of the Chaldeans, and says, go to the land, I'll show you. And Abraham heard the call and responded. That is what's happening to Rebekah. It wasn't the Lord of glory that appeared, but it was the servant of Abraham who appeared under the guidance of the angel of the Lord who brought him to this place and says, you come back with me. And Rebekah's going to have to decide, are you going to go or not? And so he's painting the story right here that he sent his angel, I am on a divine mission in fulfillment of the covenant that God has with Abraham to find this woman. He says, so I asked, well, what if the woman won't come back? Though Abraham told me, the Lord before whom I have walked will send his angel with you and make your journey a success so that you can get a wife for my son from my own clan and from my father's family. Then when you go to my clan, you will be released from my oath. Even if they refuse to give her to you, you will be released from my oath. He says, the woman has a chance to say no, or the family can say no. But realize, there is divine intervention right here. When I came to the spring today, now he goes back when he arrived, I said, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, if you will, please grant success to the journey on which I have come. See, I'm standing beside the spring. If a maiden, this is another name for her, title for her, comes out to draw water, and I say to her, please, let me drink a little water from your jar. And if she says to me, drink, and I'll draw water for your camels too, let her be the one the Lord has chosen for my master's son. In other words, I'm on a divine mission, and the angel of God is leading me to the right person. And I said, if she says this, that will be the one. And then he says, before I finished praying in my heart, meaning I didn't say it out loud, there's no way for her to know this, I'm standing there playing it cool, just on a mission from God, looking for this woman. Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder. She went down to the spring and drew water, and I said to her, please give me a drink. She quickly lowered her jar from her shoulder. And again, he watched all these details. He's watching the details of this. Lowered the jar from her shoulder and says, drink, and I'll water your camels too. So I drank, and she watered my camels also. And right there, that's a key liner there. And Laban, are you putting the story together? She's the one. The covenant of Abraham, on an oath with Abraham, I made the journey to land Abraham told me to. I prayed to God, and this is the woman. I asked her, whose daughter are you? Because Abraham wanted me to find a woman from his family. She said, the daughter of Bethuel, son of Nahor, whom Milcah bore to him. I mean, that's it. I mean, this is exactly the perfect situation. This is the only situation. She's unique. Then I put the ring in her nose and the bracelets on her arms, and I bowed down and worshiped the Lord. I praised the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who had led me on the right road to get the granddaughter of my master's brother for his son. In other words, I've already signed off this. I worshiped God and thanked him because this is the woman. All he's waiting for now is for Laban to say the same thing. Now, if you will show kindness and faithfulness to my master, tell me. And if not, tell me, so I may know which way to turn. He says, I praise God for this already because this is it. I just need you to say the same thing. I can't just steal her from you. You need to say. Now, what's interesting here is her father, Bethuel, is not mentioned in here. It's her brother doing all the dealing, Laban. And maybe Bethuel's either not in the picture, maybe he's out of town on a journey, maybe he's dead, but nonetheless, Laban is taking care of all the business. Laban and Bethuel, there's his name right there, answered. Again, we don't know anything about him. Maybe he's there, or Laban's answering for him. Maybe he's sitting there just agreeing with it, but Laban's the key player. Maybe because Laban is the one who's going to come up later again with Jacob, answered exactly what the servant wanted. This is from the Lord. We can say nothing to you one way or the other. Here is Rebekah. Take her and go, and let her become the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has directed. When Abraham's servant heard what they said, again, he bowed down to the ground before the Lord. Then the servant brought out gold and silver jewelry and articles of clothing and gave them to Rebekah, and he also gave costly gifts to her brother and her mother. Then he and the men who were with him ate and drank and spent the night there. When they got up the next morning, he said, send me on my way to my master. Now, he wants to get going. I mean, business is done, and he knows there's many obstacles that could appear. He wants to get back and deliver the package. Bring the package back home to Isaac. Fulfill the oath. He's under oath with Abraham. But her brother and her mother replied. Again, notice her brother and mother. Bethuel's not saying anything. Let the girl remain with us 10 days or so, and then you may go. That's reasonable. I mean, you showed up yesterday evening for when she was getting water for the evening meal, and you spent the night, and you want to leave this morning. It's like it's been less than 12 hours, at least less than 24 hours, and he wants to take off. Just imagine Rebecca is going to be leaving her culture, her family, going to the land that she's going to be showing. Again, very similar to what took place to Abraham. Rebecca now is responding the same way. She's joining with this vision. But they want 10 days. Give us 10 days. Now remember, when Abraham left, he spent 5 years in Haran before he actually made it to the Promised Land. He started negotiating with his family. They stopped, did some business, and lost time. And now they say, give us 10 days. Well, that's reasonable. 10 days to say goodbye to the family. But again, the servant says this. But he said to them, "Do in verse 56, do not detain me. Now that the Lord has granted success, now that I found her, you've agreed, don't stop me. I've got to bring this package home. Now that the Lord has granted me success on my journey, send me on my way so I may go to my master." Then they said, "Let's call the girl and ask her." And this is so important because this is now the family's agreed, the covenant, the contract is signed in a sense, but now Rebecca, do you want 10 more days to say goodbye to your family and prepare to leave, or do you want to go right now? And this is Rebecca's response. Then they said, "Let's call the girl and ask her about it." So they called Rebecca and asked her, "Will you go with this man? Will you be the next Abraham? Are you going to leave your family, your country, your people, go to the land that they will show you?" "I will go," she said. That's huge. "I will go." So they sent their sister Rebecca on her way along with her nurse, and her nurse's name is Deborah. We find that out in chapter 35, verse 8, when they record Deborah dying. Along with her nurse and Abraham's servant and his men, and they blessed Rebecca, and they said to her. So they sent them all on the way. She takes her possessions. They take her nurse that's been taking care of her, watching over her, and they blessed her, and they said, "Our sister, may you increase to thousands upon thousands." Because this is all about the family. This is all about the family that's coming. "May you become thousands upon thousands of people." And indeed, that took place. "May your offspring," that would be the Israelites, "possess the gates of their enemies." And the gates of their enemies is the government. That is where all the decisions were made, the courts were held. When you occupy the gates of the enemies, it doesn't mean you've just come into the city, now you control the city. That means you now have complete control of your enemies, cities, culture, transactions, business. You now control your enemies. "Our sister, may you increase to thousands upon thousands. May there be thousands and thousands of Israelites. And may the Israelites, or your descendants, occupy and control the gates of their enemies. Then Rebekah and her maids, now it's plural, got ready and mounted their camels and went back with the man. So the servant took Rebekah and left. Now, they're going to make that long journey from the north, going back down towards Hebron, down into the Negev. And when we see these next verses, again, we're about done here. When we see these next verses, the man, Isaac, is going to appear. Not necessarily going to say anything. He's not really been involved. He's simply going to receive the promise of God. He's received the inheritance. He's received the blessing. Now he's going to receive the wife that's going to bring it to the next generation, which will be given to Jacob. Now, and realize, we've talked about this before. When you look at Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, when they're mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, Hebrews chapter 11 recounts the heroes of faith in the Old Testament. Guys like Moses, talks about what Moses did. Talks about Abraham and the great things Abraham did. Talks about Noah. Talks about Joshua. All these heroic events. But then it mentions Isaac and Jacob. And when it talks about Isaac and Jacob, it simply talks about the fact that they believed the promise and handed it to the next generation. Isaac, is that is his position in life. That is his job right here, is to receive the promise, to live in that promise, to have a son, and hand the promise to the next generation. He's going to live as an alien in the land and give it to Jacob, who's going to live as an alien in the land. And it's going to be generations, four generations later, that they're actually going to come back and fulfill it. That is Isaac's job. Now, here we go. Now, Isaac had come from Beer Lahi, right? That is the well that Hagar went to when she was leaving Sarah, and the Lord appeared to her and told her that the son that she was going to have, Ishmael, was going to be blessed and he would take care of her. So what we see here, Isaac had come from Beer Lahai Roy, which is, again, in a sense, he's now controlling everything. Even where Ishmael was told he would be a great people, Isaac has that. Ishmael's going to be a great people, but it's not going to be in the promised land. Isaac now is full inheritance. He has even taken the place where the promise was made to Ishmael. He's there. He'd come from that place, for he was living in the Negev, and that would be south of Hebron. So his father lives in Hebron. Isaac is living south. He's been out on his own. So in other words, what we've got is a man. Just like it says, a man shall leave his father and mother. This man is not just a son living with his dad. He's a man on his own. He's living away from his father, which is important as we read this. He went out to the field one evening to meditate. The word meditate is a difficult word to translate, but the best idea is there. It means to talk, it means to discuss, it even means to complain. And so, meditate, it means you're talking to someone. You're communicating with someone. Well, look at it. He went out to the field one evening. There's no one with him. And this is reminiscent of what? Abraham, when God spoke to him, for example, and told him to go out and count the stars. How many nights did Abraham spend staying up? Spent up in the nights meditating, thinking about the plans that God had for him and trying to roll them through his mind, meditating on them and thinking about them. Isaac is now occupying all of the territory of Abraham, all the promise, including Ishmael's. He's alone, living in the Negev, away from his father, and he himself is out in the field in the evening, meditating and thinking about, communicating with the situations in his life before God. And he looked up. He saw camels approaching. So in that evening, he looks up, here comes camels approaching, coming in for the evening. At the same time, or it appears, Rebekah also looked up and saw Isaac. So here they are. She got down from her camel, anticipating this must be him. She doesn't know. She got down from her camel and asked the servant, "Who is that man in the field coming to meet us?" So as he sees the camels coming, he starts going towards them. She sees, she stops, gets down and says, who is that? I mean, she's got to get ready. And here's the answer the servant gives. He is my master. Again, that's important because Abraham's his master, but everything's been transferred now to the second generation, including the servant. And he realizes it. He is my master. He is the one I'm working for. The servant answers, so she took her veil and covered herself. Now, covering the veil, several things. What does the veil mean here? It could mean that she's an unmarried, but if she was unmarried, why didn't she have her face covered the whole journey? It could mean that she's engaged and she's betrothed to somebody, but then again, why wouldn't she have her face covered since she left Paddan Aram? Or it could mean, which probably, again, all those are options, it could mean that was the sign of a wedding. That was a sign of a marriage. That was a sign of when she would come, that she'd cover their face and be presented to their husband. And so I think what she's doing here, my interpretation of this, you can think about it. So she took, who is that? That is my master. So she takes her veil and covers her face. Why? Because that's what she came for. She came to do what? To marry this man. So she covers her veil. She's ready for the wedding. I mean, what are we waiting for? I mean, I'm here. I'm not going to like date him. We're not going to court, see if we get along with each other. It's like, it's wedding time. She pulls her veil down. That's what I think. Verse 66. Then the servant told Isaac all he had done. Now, you're glad that we don't have that recorded, and I'd read it to you for a third time. But he tells all. We assume he's going to tell Abraham also later, which would be a fourth time. This is already the longest chapter in Genesis, and I've read it to you in one day. Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah. Now realize that's not to meet Sarah because Sarah has died and been buried. Why does he go to Sarah's tent? Because right here, Rebekah now is in that position of Sarah. She is the matriarch of the family of the promise. And he brings her in, and that, you know, again, taking her to the tent and said, well, this is where you'll stay tonight. I mean, she's got the veil down. They come into the tent. He shows this is where you'll be living. And again, this is probably where the marriage took place. He married Rebekah. So, I mean, that night, she pulls the veil down, goes to Sarah's tent. They wake up the next morning, husband and wife. She is now in the family and heir of the promise. So she became his wife, and he loved her. Now, I just want you to notice right here, it's interesting. This is reminiscent of Ephesians chapter 5. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. Watch this right here and what they do for each other. So she became his wife, and he loved her. Again, that's not necessarily mentioned in the Old Testament very often, that the husband loves his wife. But Isaac loves her. Again, we got Jacob and Rachel loving each other. But so she became his wife, and he loved her. And watch this. And Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So Isaac loves Rebekah, but in response, Rebekah, the wife, she comforts Isaac. And again, it mentions his mother's death right here. Again, is that it's been 3 years at least. Is that what was bothering him? Is that what he's meditating about? Is his mom's dead? Whatever, but it does say that he was comforted. Or at least from this point on, they've moved completely into the next generation. Abraham and Sarah, Abraham's still alive, but they've now passed the side. And now it's Isaac and Rebekah. Isaac is comforted with the presence of Rebekah. And what you see right there at the end of the story is Isaac loving the wife or loving the woman, the wife or the woman comforting or taking care of and doing her part with her husband. Like I said, just exactly like what you see in Ephesians. And that is our chick script for the day. And they lived happily ever after. Again, there's a story in that. I suppose it would make a decent movie. There needs to be a little more conflict. Someone's got to, like, you know, invade the caravan or something and steal Rebekah, or, you know, Laban does something. You know, there's got to be some more of the story. But the thing is, there is more of the story coming. And that's where you're going to have Jacob and Esau, and Rebekah's going to have the twins, and all kinds of things are going to take place. And Jacob's going to end up with four wives from Padan Aram. So again, it's a nice story right there, longest chapter. And the reason I think it's in there, the reason it's important, is not only do you see God interacting with people in their daily lives and how they interact, Abraham trusting God, the servant trusting God, Rebekah trusting God, Isaac responding, all these people agreeing, God being very important in their lives. But the main point right there, and the reason I think it's there, is you see all those promises from chapter 12 of Genesis up to this point that God said he was going to do. And for years, Sarah didn't have any children. It looks like the promise was dead. Abraham's trying to figure it out. Here it is, the culmination. It wasn't Eliezer. It wasn't Ishmael and Hagar. It was Isaac. And here's Isaac. Now he's got the wife, the perfect wife, the wife God chose. And now the promise is in the second generation, which just gives validity to the promises that have been made. It's like this is on its way. And again, it's like getting a train going. Once this thing starts rolling from generation to generation, they're going to come out of Egypt, you know, 2 million people plus. It's like these people cannot be stopped because they have the promise and covenant of God. Father, we do thank you so much for your truth. We thank you for your word. And we do ask that we may apply these things to our lives, that we may understand, that we may pray, that we may trust you, that we may hear your promise and walk in those, that we may live a way that is honorable to you. Again, we thank you for this word. And ask that we would, again, trust you and have our confidence placed in you and who you are and what you're doing in our lives. We give you praise in Jesus' name. Amen.